are back. Welcome to No Direction Beyond, your Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm your host, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I am joined by...
Alexander Agunis, the Everyman Gamer, back from Disney World.
James, I write Code Switch and never do second takes usually.
And I'm Owen Casey Stevens, I'm the Starfinder design lead.
And speaking of which... Thank you, Owen, for joining us on No Direction Beyond. It is criminal that it has taken us this long to get you on this show.
No problem. I appreciate y'all making the time.
Awesome. Awesome. I have to console Jason Keeley. He cannot be on for a sixth time. Actually, no, we'll take Jason any time he's free to do it, honestly. But we are...
I am still significantly behind him on total number of times on, which he is lording over me even just today at the office.
You know, I've been on there 5 more times than you, Owen. That's funny. Yeah, no, it was on Twitter, too. It was really funny. But there's a lot of people on your team we haven't had on. We've never had Amanda. We've never had Rob. We never had Joe. We never had Chris.
That is everyone else on the team.
Yeah,
I know.
And I have emails out to try to solve all this already. Do not worry. As soon as I get the excuses, I will be asking to have all of them on the show. Not at once. That would be interesting. But not at once. Anyway, but we are here.
Crazy.
We are here to talk to Owen Casey Stevens, the Starfinder Design lead, not league. There's a whole league of you.
It feels that way sometimes.
The Starfinder. What does it mean to be the Starfinder Design lead?
So we are our own team that have a whole suite of role-playing game products we're putting out. We've got the hardback books. We've got the adventure books. We've got accessories and stuff that come out. And I am the primary person whose number one concern is the design of the game. That is specifically the design environment, the rules of the game, how it's being interacted with, whether there are things that we should modify, what direction we want to take stuff. So my primary focus when we are worrying about design type materials is that design, as opposed to, say, the creative director, which is Rob McCurry, who has a more high scale picture over the entire game line.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're coming up on a year of Starfinder. How do you think it has gone? How's this year been?
It's been a crazy year. I'm very, very enthused and a little bit humbled about how this game has been received. We sold out in a matter of hours on the first day that we were selling it at Gen Con, and that is after we brought significantly more copies of this than any product we had ever brought and not sold out of before. A lot of people seem very, very excited. There are times in which the fact that I, for example, am looking at answering frequently asked questions in errata that I think, oh, we got everything wrong. But we didn't. We got a lot of this right. And a lot of people did a lot of great work on it. And I'm very impressed with how the third-party community has embraced it and how well Organized Play has just run with it and done some fantastic things with it. And how many fans have really become very, very engaged with it, as well as some of the Real Play podcasts and such, which are just all spectacularly impressive.
Excellent. And it seems people do agree with you on that. You guys recently won the Origin Award for Fan Favorite RPG.
Yes, we did.
And you also have been nominated for 7 Innies. Just to list them off here. Best Aid and Accessory for the Starfinder Geome Screen. Best Art Interior for the Starfinder Core Rulebook. Best Cartography for the Starfinder Pact Worlds. Best Free Product for Starfinder First Contact. Best Monster Adversary Book for the Starfinder Alien Archive. And you better believe it on that one. Best Setting for the Starfinder Pact Worlds. And Product of the Year... the Starfinder Core Rulebook.
We also have Best Free Product, I believe, for the First Contact.
Oh, yes. Best Free Product for Starfinder First Contact. That is an impressive amount of any nominations for a single product line.
It really is. And, of course, those are spread out over pretty much everything we've released so far for the book, mm-hmm. Or for the line. But, yeah, it's very, very gratifying to see that work is recognized and popular and that people are enjoying it. Mm-hmm.
Now, we are certainly enjoying it here. We wouldn't be doing this podcast if we didn't. But you talked about the books that have come out. So far for the game, we have had the Core World book, we have had the Pact Worlds book, and we've had the Alien Archive. And we've also had a slew of society modules, enough supporting products to drown my shelf over there. Way many of them. And of course, the Adventure Path line, which is just finished wrapping up Dead Sons. And we'll be moving on to future Adventure Paths coming up effective Gen Con. Now, how many pages do you think you have personally been responsible for that headed out that door?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, zero pages that I'm solely responsible for, right? This is all a team effort. So, you know, I get credit for some part of maybe 300 pages of the core rule book. But even there, we're talking about if I had a freelancer design part of the equipment section, and then I developed it, and then it went off to another developer to look at, and then we had to change some rules elements, so it came back and I changed some of the numbers so that things would be balanced, etc. There are, and then someone has to lay it out, and someone else edited it, and probably three someone else has edited it. So there's nothing that I would say I am solely or even primarily responsible for on page count. I've probably cranked out 400 or 500 pages worth of material for this game in one form or another. But, you know, I wrote the last adventure for Dead Sons, The Empire of Bones. Even that is only part of that book. And the basic concept came from Rob McCreary, our creative director. He and I worked on an outline together. I wrote a rough draft, but then it went to Jason Keeley, who did the development on it, and then it went to at least Liz Liddell as an editor, and I know there were other editors that worked on it as well. So even for the pages that I say I wrote these, that's only one part of the machine that is Paizo, trying to make sure that we are generating worthwhile, interesting, well-developed, well-edited content.
Mm-hmm. And generating a lot of content is key. You guys have actually had to kick it into a higher gear. You've doubled the amount of society being put out, and our effective Gen Con will be doubling the amount of Adventure Path. So it's clear to see that demand is holding strong.
Yes, demand is holding very, very strong. It's true. We were originally doing one Adventure Path adventure every other month, which is why a year in we are finishing the first six Adventure Path. We actually ramped up production quite a while ago because it takes a long time to go from our end being done to a book being in people's hands. There's the layout and the editing and the printing and the shipping and the warehousing. But we brought new people on. We have Chris Sims and Joe Bassini on the team. Amanda Hammond-Kunz, who had helped us with the core rule book and then had become a managing editor, actually, I think sometime during that process, and then has come back to be a managing developer for Starfinder, so she's back with us. So we've got a good six-person team now. And of course, Thurston Hillman does development for the organized play scenarios and organized play, brought on another person as well recently to help them with the increased demand. So we are trying to make sure that we have the necessary personnel to meet demand, but that's always a race, and you don't want to ramp up to the point that you're producing more content than people want. And, you know, a year in even, there are a lot of games that no one remembers now that were selling well 1 year after they were released. So we want to make sure that we take a intelligent, experienced view of how to make this game line something that will last, that people can keep enjoying, and that we can release stuff at a reasonable rate that people can use it instead of just flooding the market.
Wow. I'm just in awe of like the amount of work that you go through and recognize for it. It's just, you know, it's cool to see somebody take that much appreciation, everything around them, the machine for it.
Oh yeah, I am a cog, and I am a particular shiny cog, but I am one cog in a big machine that produces these things. And I know from experience how much work the people around me are doing on everything. And one of the reasons that Paizo likes to have all our developers in-house, for example, is if I am working on something and I think to myself, I can't tell if this idea is brilliant or stupid, I can immediately turn to Joe Pacini next to me and I can say, Joe, is this brilliant or stupid? Now, Joe might well look at me and say, this is both brilliant and stupid. Which do you want to? But the point is that feedback can come immediately. And that is a very useful part of making a product that holds together, where everything makes sense and we're keeping track of what we're doing with what we do in the future.
Okay. Well, I'm having a brain fart. Alex, save me.
Oh, I was going to make the comment about how James and I mentioned to James that Owen is basically the living embodiment of a Axiomite NC. This kind of proves it. I told you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, on top of all the other work that I have heard that you do and have seen some of, doing this on top of it really increases my all for you as a developer.
That's incredibly embarrassing. Thank you.
I'm amazed that you guys have a team of six, which is a lot more than a lot of other game companies have working on the product line. But it doesn't seem like it's anywhere near enough for the amount of material you guys are putting out and the quality of it. That is, like, we've reviewed all of the hardbacks that have come out so far, and they have, with the exception of like the editing mistakes we all know about in the core rulebook, the other books have just been like phenomenally well put together.
Well, and again, when we say a six-person team, that's a six-person design and development team, right? So we have yet more people who are working on layout. Our creative director of graphic design and art, Sarah Robinson, has done a tremendous job with the visual look of this game. And that is something that started before we even were trying to get art for the specific game. Very early on, we were having conversations where she would say things like, so if the Vesk are a military race, what kind of ranks do they have? Now, that isn't even something that we have officially discussed, right? But we could sit down and say, okay, this is what we're picturing for that. Why? And she'd say, well, I need to know if, you know, we're going to have officers have one look, if we're going to have enlisted people have another look, if they're mostly Space Marines, are they mostly barbarians, are they tribal? Those are discussions we could have so that she could get concept art of a lot of the stuff. And we'd say, okay, this is what a Vesk looks like. This is what Obaziah, our iconic Vesk soldier, specifically looks like. This is what a Dashko looks like. Up till now, for example, I don't think we've actually put in any book what a regular Dashko looks like, which is the three-spiked axe-like weapon of the Vesk. We've had fire Dashko, flame Dashkos, we've had plasma Dashkos. I think we even have an ice Dashko in one of the books. But we have not just put, here's a regular old Dashko, a tactical Dashko. But we know what that looks like thanks to the concept art, which is part of her whole part of that process. And as a result, we can reference it when we're doing different versions of it and have that kind of consistency. Similarly, the editing team is another whole group of people. Although, to call out, Rob McCurry originally came to Paizo as an editor. Jason Keeley originally came to Paizo as an editor. Joe Pacini originally came to Paizo as an editor. Pretty much, Amanda has done editing work. Pretty much everyone on the team is able to be an editor but me. So there is another level of being able to polish stuff. But again, there's another whole group of people that do that. So while there are six of us worrying about the content of the words, a lot of that polish is coming from the very hard, very professional work of other people that work at Paizo.
Why do you think it is that Starfinder did catch on? Like, what? There's been sci-fi games in the past, so why is this the one that really hit it?
I think there are a number of factors that have worked very, very well for us. First of all, I think that sci-fi and sci-fantasy, well, first of all, it's a science fantasy game. I think that is one of the advantages. A lot of people like adding really fantastic elements to their gaming. It's a quick, fun way to have options that you can play with without necessarily having to worry about the physics of firing a shotgun in zero-G, for example. If you're trying to do Apollo 13, the role-playing game, and you say, okay, we're going to have three people in this capsule, make a skill check to determine how many pounds of fuel we need in each of the different rocket boosters, that can be a very accurate science fiction game. Even if you try and add adventure elements to it, people frequently kind of rebel that, well, if everything else is so realistic. As soon as you say there are gods, there's a form of hyperspace that was handed by a robot god to different people at different times, there are spellcasters, there's psychic energy, there are dragons. I think people find it much easier to let go and say, okay, this is supposed to be fun. The number one thing is to do action adventure. And if there are little things that bother players or GMs, right? If someone goes, well, I don't understand how lightning guns work in a vacuum without any kind of medium for the electricity to go over. Even if that bothers them, they can say, I'll just assume that part's magic. And so there's a lot of, I think, hand waving that works in our favor. Pathfinder was obviously extremely popular, both as a game system and as a setting. And so tying to that gave us a leaping off point where we could say, hey, we're only telling you what, for example, 20 of the gods are. But if you're a fan of having more material, you know that Pathfinder has another 50, 60 gods in it so that you can go burrowing down. So it's like we started with expansion material already in place. One of the things we heard a lot was people saying, well, but there's only one rule book and there aren't nearly as many options as I would like for there to be. But because we have that other material there, if there's lore you're looking for, it's easy to dig that stuff up. You don't even have to buy products. A lot of that lore is material available on wikis and such. And if it's rules content, a lot of third-party people have come in and said, well, this obviously is a game world that comes from a place that has inquisitors and witches and other things, and we can do Starfinder versions of that, which means that that third-party product line came in early. I think Paizo made a very smart decision to allow third-party publishers to support this game with third-party material on day one. So you could sign up as a third-party company for early access to sort of the mechanical part of the rules, not the setting material that isn't available for open game content use, but the core rules. And a number of companies in those first few weeks had products out just the moment the game was available. So there was even more stuff than Paizo could make available on day one, even including adventures and such. I think the organized play team deserves just a huge lion's share of credit. One of the things that can make a new game coming out difficult to get purchase is people don't have time to come up with their own adventures, and it doesn't start with a whole lot of adventures available. I mean, we did have our first Dead Sons adventure path available when we released this, but that's one adventure. And if you play that and you guys get together more often in 2 months than it takes you to run through one of those, there was no official content from us other than the organized play material. And they had a lot of material early on. They've brought in their own lore. They're getting a lot of fan favorites. They're recognizing that. And they're adding some awesome stuff to the entire setting, which is material that we on the sort of rulebook adventure path team might not even have thought of. It's a great way to have more minds thinking more creative stuff. And that's just more options for people to latch on to. So I think that's an important part of it. Mm-hmm. But also, I think that the time was right. There sort of was a gap where maybe there were not a lot of things I would consider to be popular science fantasy movies coming out. But as we release this, there are Star Wars movies again. There's a rebooted set of Star Trek movies. Guardians of the Galaxy was very, very popular and clearly has some less than pure hard sci-fi elements to it. The Aliens movies are coming back. I think there's been a resurgence in sort of source material for that is easily accessible, even on television. And that whole sort of geek renaissance of all this new material, I think helps spark people have interest in more different kinds and specifically science fantasy kinds of stories. And interest in those stories and things to be inspired by are, I think, one of the things that makes a game able to catch on quickly and do well.
Yeah.
Now, it's been almost a year, and definitely you had your plan for what Starfinder was going to be coming out, but plans change. Things happen in the community. What has happened? What has happened post release that has surprised you, or has influenced the game direction?
Well, we already mentioned that the demand was higher than we expected, I think it was not only higher than we expected, it was higher than we sort of hoped in our wildest dreams. As a business, right, when you're deciding things like how many products are we going to have ready on day one, how big can they be, how many can we print, you've got questions about, well, if this is a tremendous flop, how much money have we sunk in this that we can't get back, how many people would we have to lay off, et cetera. So there's a reason why we had an adventure path every other month, because we just didn't want to spend a ton of money putting out more material than people wanted or needed, and not have any time to make adjustments. As it happens, that first adventure path was received very, very well. Mm-hmm. But not only was the first one out day one, right, but the second one was out of our hands by the time the core book came out. If we had been doing them one a month from the get-go, if we'd wanted to make adjustments in the length of it or the back matter or the formatting or any of that, we really would have had the whole adventure path largely set in stone before the game came out. And so that longer time meant that we could get at least some feedback for the last half of the adventure path. And mostly, I think, we saw that people liked what we were doing. But we certainly are paying attention, especially in the Paizo.com Starfinder forums. We take a look at those. We try and keep track of it. There has been some errors that we snuck into the book, no matter how hard you try and fix those. And it's been really nice to see a lot of people will say, oh, this information seems to be missing. And then they'll say, well, it looks like you could use this solution, or maybe this is supposed to be it. And the community comes together really, really strongly to support each other. And we can't answer every question as soon as someone asks it. So seeing a friendly community on the forums making suggestions for each other is really gratifying and not necessarily something I expected to have happen. And then there are things like Skittermanders are more popular than we would have expected, for example. My wife, who's off to the side, just squealed in delight at the word Skittermanders. You can probably hear her laughing as I speak. Yeah. And so, right, we release Skittermanders, they're a huge hit, and then we're like, well, we've got a free RPG Day product coming along, maybe we should do a Skittermander adventure and see how that's received. Oh, we are doing a Starfinder comic backup feature in the back of the Pathfinder comics, maybe those should feature Skittermanders. And those are ways that before we do something like, say, Skittermanders are core, or there are five subspecies of Skittermanders, we're going to do the ultimate Skittermander, will be a new hardback book, without having to go there, right? We can take this idea that they're a popular mascot icon, and we can roll them out in other formats and see how people respond to them. But at the same time, organized play can say, well, even with the cantina scene, we don't want to have a game where everyone is playing a hyper-intelligent shade of blue. So here is a way where we can take those weirder races that we want to be part of the Starfinder setting, but we can put them in a controlled way and see what their reaction is. And then maybe we make an adjustment to what those are going to be later on. I think that's a very important feedback mechanism. And the enthusiasm has just meant that some of that feedback mechanism has both happened a little faster than we expected, but also it's taken us in directions that we would not have originally predicted.
I do have a question, because I never gave this any thought about the organized play team making up lore, and your team maybe wanting to implement it in a different way. Is that how often of a two-way street is that? Are they more free to take stuff from your core line, or is it kind of like a 50-50 and you guys run it by each other?
So certainly we do our very best to stay in communication, right? They do an excellent job of telling us what their overall plan is and what their individual adventure plans are. That actually mostly doesn't come to the majority of us, right? That is content type material. So the creative director, Rob McCreary, keeps an eye on that and says, yes, this seems like it's a Starfinder kind of thing, or I'd like some more information on this so we can see how it would fit it in. We also try to stay out of each other's ways too much. So, I mean, like Zoe, which is a very popular character, Zio! Exclamation point, showed up first in organized play, but he was very popular. We liked him. We put him in the Pact Worlds as an example character, right? We've got him illustrated and everything. We don't want them to do adventures that like blow up Eox, right? Because we want Eox around to play with, and they know better than to blow up Eox. But one of the great things about Starfinder is that they could say, hey, here's a very important planet full of gargoyles or whatever they wanted that we are using in organized play. And then if they wanted to have an interactive special where they say, if you guys lose this, the planet blows up and no one gets to play with it anymore, they could do that without impacting the rest of the campaign setting. It's also one of the things I like about third-party products, right? If someone says, hey, here's a new solar system, they can say, here's a new solar system. You can use this as the core solar system of your campaign. But you can also just say, here is one of 10,000 solar systems people know how to get to, and a GM can drop it in a single adventure if he wants to.
Wow, that's cool. I never gave it any thought, but that's really cool.
I mean, they have a ton of experience, the organized play team does, working with things like the campaign setting books and the adventure path line on the Pathfinder side. So they already have a lot of experience on how this works. And we largely try to give them their lead while at the same time trying to say, yes, the creative director may have concerns. I've been asked, you know, hey, is this something we want weapons to do? Cause we want to introduce a new weapon. And I can say, yeah, that's fine. Or, you know, maybe that's, I mean, I'm the person that created Grenades of Wonder, which are in the Armory book coming out. So I'm not necessarily a person who's going to say, no, weapons shouldn't do that. But it is a question where if we're creating new mechanics, they tend to run those by us, and that's great. And then we can have a consistent feel throughout the entire thing.
Well, speaking of the Grenades of Wonder, the next book coming out for Starfinder, the next hardback coming out, it'll be releasing at Gen Con, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
Is going to be Starfinder's Armory. What can you tell us briefly about that book?
It has third level weapons in it.
Oh.
So
that is very brief. Thank you.
All of our ears perked up like, oh.
But one of the things people noticed when we released the core rulebook is there is not literally not a single weapon that has an item level of 3. And that is because mathematically you don't have to have a weapon at every level, right? That these things go up by certain specific quanta, and you do not have to have an upgrade at every single level. And we don't necessarily think you're going to want to stick with a laser pistol your entire career. So you may hop around for other options. Stuff gets dropped as loot, etc. But not having a single weapon of a given level was sort of an oversight. We didn't notice when we were doing the tables because we wanted to make sure there was what you needed at each level. At a third level, you can adventure with second level equipment just fine, especially weaponry, so it wasn't an issue. But that is the sort of gap in what is available that we wanted to patch. We wanted to make sure that there was, you know, powered armor at a lot of different levels and different kinds of light and heavy armor and more armor upgrades, and specifically more armor upgrades that make sense for an android to use in their racial ability that allows them to use armor upgrades.
I mean, the butt jetpack was one of my favorites.
I mean, that's great, but at first level, that's not an option. And of course, the actual jetpack, I think, takes up 2 slots, so you can't actually cram it into an android unless they are ridiculously obese. Which, you know, they just have little hands and legs sticking out, and they otherwise look like a potato with jets, right? A big intake for a mouth.
No, no, you get a compact jetpack, and you put one thruster in each cheek.
No. Well, it's probably in the case of things we're not doing. So there were a lot of places where we're like, we want more magic items, we want more different weapon types, we want to support different gameplay types that people have been talking about. A fair amount of that book came from, that was late enough in the process when we were actually outlining it, that we'd already gotten some feedback on the core rulebook, and so we knew some of the things that people wanted to see more of. And we had seen, for example, that the idea of having some player-facing rules in the Alien Archive that tied to various alien species was well received. So we were like, well, we're putting new equipment into this book. If you wanted to play an equipment-themed character, it makes sense to have sort of some equipment-themed class features in the book, for example. So those are just ways where we were trying to make sure that we knew we didn't have absolutely everything you could possibly want in Starfinder in the core rulebook. Part of that was a space issue. Armory's 160 pages long. The core rulebook's already more than 500 pages long. I don't know that a 700-page core rulebook would have been well received, and we would have needed another 6 months to put it together and print out, and poor postman having deliver it would probably have hurt themselves. But also some of it was, you know, let's put out the sort of core material that we think is most important for people to play with, and then see what feedback we get, and then we can take what I personally consider another core book, right? This is like the Alien Archive, which tells you things like how to make an alien and how to have summoning spells. This is another book that answers some very basic questions. Pact World similarly takes our core setting and gives you more information about it, so that if you are satisfied with what's in the core rulebook, that's great. You can play a game just fine with all that. But if you are the sort of people that think, I really want more guns, more grenades, more cybernetic upgrades, or we had necrographs show up that we had not originally described, and those were in one of the APs. We're like, well, those were very popular. A lot of people liked them, so let's do those and add some more. So that is a thing that's in the book. That's how we tried to fill this book with as much desired, useful gaming goodness as we could possibly pack between the two covers.
So along the same lines with that note about necrographs being the book, are we going to see a lot of reprints from like Pack Worlds and the Adventure Path volumes in Armory?
Certainly nothing from Pack Worlds, I don't think. Again, I consider Pack Worlds sort of a core book, and the stuff in the Pack Worlds is sort of specific to the Pack Worlds, so there's no need to put that in the Armory. I don't think we picked up anything from Alien Archive either, because again, that's already in a core hardback. There are a few things, not everything by a stretch, but there are a few things that have shown up in Adventure Paths where we thought, okay, that was an idea that we did not originally have. It's popular. It plugs a niche, so we will take that, and necrographs as an example, a disintegrator class weapons.
Yes.
And we will have some of that in this book, because if that is something that is particularly popular and a lot of people are using it in a lot of cases, having it in a hardback book as a single reference is just more helpful. But we mostly want this to be a book of new material. The vast majority of the stuff that we had custom written for it, and that I and Joe Piscini and that Chris Sims spent a lot of time developing, including a period of time known as the Reckoning, where we were all like, okay, I've done this with magic items. What have you done with hybrid items? Well, I did this. Okay, well, that language ought to be the same. So there was a period where we were all trying to make sure that everything we had done with everything was all gelled together.
I am so happy that disintegrator weapons are back. There's something really satisfying about rolling a d20 for damage.
That is one of the reasons I did that with disintegrator. I mean, I wrote the original disintegrator article, and I wanted there to be a number of reasons why they sort of weren't core weapons. And the fact that a d20 has an average of 10.5 points of damage, which is real close to 3d6. But if you are a military, you probably prefer a weapon with a bell curve where most of your damage is hitting this predictable level rather than a disintegrator where there is no telling how much damage you can do. But if you are a crazed bounty hunter space pirate psycho, yeah, a disintegrator might sound good. So they were popular. I'm glad that we added them and we expanded them somewhat.
Are we going to see disintegrator melee weapons? Can I take a sword and dissolve body parts with it?
So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time revealing all of the secrets of what is in Armory. I'm happy to talk about it in broad terms. But for example, you know, we've got preview blogs coming out and such, and we do want you to buy the book to answer some of these questions. So, but I'll be entirely honest, I don't remember any disintegrator melee weapons. That doesn't mean there aren't any. But if so, it's certainly not a great big category.
If only I knew a third-party publisher who could fix this problem.
Well, maybe somebody will.
If only
will.
You, the Everyman Gamer, knew someone that had a third-party publisher.
If only. Together.
I mean, I could see disintegrator maces, right? Or,
right?
You know, you might pick a weirder weapon, right? You might have the Bec de Corban be the standard disintegrator shape.
Ready?
And then since the Bec de Corban in Pathfinder is particularly good against armor, right? You could actually have a critical hit effect be disintegrates armor.
Listen, ready? Disintegrator chakrams.
That is right up there with lightsaber nunchucks as weapons. I don't know that I... But that's actually also not that dissimilar from the discs from Tron, right? Which are throwing discs. You hit someone, they derez. So
that's why it's great. You gotta take it, and like something about the kinetic force of being thrown triggers the disintegrate, so like it doesn't disintegrate you while you're holding it. It's great.
It sounds expensive, and what happens when you miss?
Everything happens.
It's a disintegrator pistol, and when it disintegrates, it disintegrates.
We've talked about that in space combat. Like, yeah, you guys fired a bunch of rockets and railguns out in the space. Who knows where they'll land eventually?
Well, so here's the advantage. Space is big. I mean, if you think it's a long walk from your house down to the local corner store, that's peanuts compared to space. Yeah. So for the most part, if you fire things off into space, nothing will happen. They may never hit anything. And if they do hit something, it's likely to be the thing with the biggest gravity well. And the things with the biggest gravity wells are stars, which mostly don't care how many railguns you fire into them.
And right there, that is the pitch line for the Dawn of Flame adventure path that's coming out. How many railguns can you shoot at the sun?
So don't care about railguns.
What happens when the sun shoots back?
Now, I think some of this excitement might actually be the answer to this question, but you mentioned this being in your mind one of the core books of Starfinder.
Yeah.
Why did you guys decide to go with the Starfinder's, I guess, equivalent to Alderman equipment so early in its life?
Yeah, excitement was definitely part of it. Another part of it is that we know how popular Ultimate Equipment was, and the people who made Ultimate Equipment did not, when they were thinking about whether or not to make it, know how popular Ultimate Equipment was going to be. When I am playing Pathfinder, it is very, very common to see someone have the core rulebook and Ultimate Equipment and nothing else with them because there's so much stuff in there that they consider to be core to their character.
That's,
right.
And, that's me. Wow, you just named me. It's great.
So that is an example of being aware that a big book full of equipment can very quickly be something that expands the game. We also knew very early on that people were saying, we want more weapons, we want more grenades, we want more powered armor, we want more cybernetics. That was probably one of the strongest sets of requests, right? There's other stuff that people really, really wanted too. They want a Starship book. Obviously, we want a Starship book. We can't do everything all at once. So we had to pick what's the next thing. And so these hardbacks are sort of coming out in the order of up through Armory, the order of what was absolutely most critical in our minds. So Core Rule Book, obviously it's Core. Alien Archive, we wanted you to be able to shoot things with the character you made in the Core Rule Book. And that is also why we included full character creation rules in there. And also saved the summoning rules to there, because we could have put summoning spells in the Core Rule Book, but there would have been nothing to summon yet, which seems like it would be less fun. So that seemed really, really, really crucial. And then the Pact Worlds is our core setting. And a lot of people were very excited about it. That is where our organized play is. And people had questions almost immediately about, you know, what's actually going on Eox. We had a 2-page spread with a giant double truck piece of art for each world in the Core Rule Book. And that's great for giving you a drop of an idea. But if people are going to set adventures there or even have characters from there, sort of at least a more basic gazetteer that takes a few pages to describe, it seems really crucial. So that seemed like a critical book to have. And then when we're looking out the line, having done, here's the core rules, here's the monsters, here's the place, here's the rest of the stuff, seemed like a natural next step for a core book. And I don't know if anyone else is going to consider it core or not, right? I mean, I'm not making a declaration about what the official core of Starfinder is. But I strongly suspect that at my desk, I'm going to have Core Rule Book, Alien Archive, Pact Worlds, and Armory, and for a lot of future projects, I'm going to be diving back to those books for things we haven't even announced yet that I'm working on, and those things come up more than most of the other material we've put out.
Does the fact that Starfinder is a science fantasy game, leaning on the science part here, is that another reason why this book was more important than it would have been, say, if Starfinder was another fantasy game?
I think so. I mean, Ultimate Equipment has a lot of magic items in it, right? And that makes sense. We have a lot of different kinds of technology that do really different things. So a lot of our weapons are similar, but, you know, some unlike in Pathfinder, where your basic weapon is either a bash, stab, or cut, either here or at range, and that is pretty much all they do, whatever little tweaks you put in, right? We've got flamethrowers and impact cannons that fire a cone of shrapnel, and even with all of that, we're only scratching the surface of what science fiction tells us we can do with technology and weapons. So we really wanted to both give you a lot more options than the stuff that was common, but also say what else might advanced science make that we can give people rules for that makes sense to be in this universe. And then again, you know, I remember one of my favorite things for Shadowrun, for example, back in first edition Shadowrun in the 90s, was the Samurai Street Catalog. I loved that thing. My copy got so dog-eared it fell apart. So now I only own a PDF, I think. I might still have a copy I bought used floating back there somewhere. But that, again, is a case for the people that enjoy the science fantasy game. They frequently like the idea. There are a lot of people for a fantasy game who do not like the idea that there is a magic item shopping mall, right? They want it to be mystic and strange, and I'm good with that as a story. But if what you want is a plasma bazooka, most people accept that somewhere there is an arms dealer whose job is to sell you a plasma bazooka. And that means that we have to have these things at different levels, right? I mean, there are in the real world places where you can buy tanks and armed destroyers and armed helicopters, right? Vehicles and military grade stuff can just be bought. So we have to support that to a certain extent to have that entire play style be able to be fulfilled, and so that the GM has lots of things to give bad guys. So when you kill them, you care about taking their stuff.
Does the plasma bazooka shoot miniature suns?
No. Next question.
you mentioned that the people don't want a magic item shopping mall, but it seems like somewhere in Starfinder, probably on Absalom Station, there absolutely would be a magic item shopping mall with a Better Bombs and Gardens in it.
Yeah, absolutely, totally.
Wait, we rewind. Did you say Better Bombs and Gardens?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, but why would you buy a whole garden at a shopping mall? Like, isn't the point to, like, till and plant your own garden?
Alex, do you think you buy gardens at home and garden stores?
No, that's what I thought. That's what Parham just said. I think you, like, buy the supplies and go out and make your garden in your house.
That's what a garden store does.
We've dwelled Alex. Way too much. We have killed this joke. It's been beaten bloody.
No, I'm so confused.
That's okay.
It's okay.
I mean, I think part of the original equipment that we've had a lot of fun with is your mundane base equipment at our tables. Like, after there was a scenario where a lot of us got lit on fire for a disturbingly long amount of time, we all went and we bought a fire extinguisher. So it is a joke where we all go, y'all got your fire extinguishers, are heading in. And radiation suits was just added to that. So that's been a good, as opposed to Pathfinder, where in general it's like, oh, you got rope? Okay, I guess that's it. So it's been fun.
I mean, I have characters that have, once you get the bag of holding, right, that have sheets and sheets and sheets of things. I was playing an adventure my wife was running where we were at very low level attacked by skunks. And they were just devastating the party, and we didn't want to kill them. And I had, because of a previous adventure, I had picked up 10 wicker baskets and stuck them. And at that point, it was a cart that we were pulling along. So we all grabbed a wicker basket and we're running around trying to capture skunks in wicker baskets so that we can move them to an area of safety where they won't be bothering the merchant who's paying us to keep his store appealing without having to kill them, and while trying to contain the stench in a smaller area than us. So I'm a big fan of having a lot of equipment as options for the character and the player and the GM that wants to have that equipment know what it's like. That is also why the core rulebook says, hey, if there's something in the real world that there's equivalent of, right, like a wristwatch, you can probably get it for 5 credits in negligible bulk. Because that way, if someone says, hey, can I get a pill organizer? Sure, there is no reason you can't. We're just never going to pile everything that could be bought on Amazon.com into a rule book. as much as I think a Titan.com shopping store joke might be worth cramming into a product somewhere.
That's a lot of space for product.
Right.
I can go with that, because then you can do a Starfinder Society scenario where the party is contractually delivering to a really difficult address. But it's guaranteed.
Actually, I'd rather go the other direction with it, and you work for a Titan.com warehouse, and there is a missing item because, like, it's a war robot and it's gone loose. So you have to go running down the aisles to capture this war robot so that it can be deactivated and shipped off. But you're not allowed, you're only allowed to shoot, you know, or you're only allowed to use melee weapons, because if you use ranged weapons, you might accidentally blow up someone's Tickle Me Elmo. And then we could have a chart of random things that you end up hitting if you. Why do they even have stainless steel juicer sticks here? I don't understand.
Well, do you know what would be really funny if, like, at the end of the scenario, you have to total up everything that was destroyed on, like, a random chart, and then, like, you subtract that many credits from everybody's, like, overall rewards.
Congratulations. Your reward is a bill for 27 credits. You guys blew up some very expensive gaming systems back in Isle 42, so... Good news is you're now the proud owners of 87 damaged Sega 2000s.
Listen, no, but I feel like if you take this idea to John and Thirsty, they will let you do this. Like, this is a thing that could happen. It could be real.
I will add it to my giant list of things to do when I have spare time.
I think it's the only day job role where you get negatives.
Just in case the rest of you don't know, that list is located in, like, an eldritch vault underneath Paizo. You have to, like, walk down several flights of stairs. It's as long as a basilisk now. And Owen just sighs deeply as he writes the thing and leaves.
I mean, every once in a while I get to go down there and pick something off the list to be the next thing I actually spend time on. But that's less often than adding things to it, I promise.
It's a glorious day.
It is.
Speaking of things you spent time on, I think we kind of skipped over this and we shouldn't have. You mentioned that you wrote the ending of Dead Sons.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The last adventure in Dead Sons is Empire of Bones, mm-hmm. I wrote it. It is the first adventure path I have managed to write for Paizo, despite having been working on writing an adventure path adventure for Paizo and having been assigned to 3 times over the past decade. But various factors, including at one point a combination of hurricanes and kidney stones, have kept me from ever managing to get it. I had really begun to think I was cursed. So I am delighted to have finally managed to do that. It is the final adventure. It's up in the teens. And you guys get to go to an Ultronaut, the biggest ship you have ever seen or likely heard of, and face more undead than you can shake a stick at in an effort to save the universe from the risks of the corpse fleet getting a hold of a giant mega weapon. It's a lot of fun, in my opinion.
I was going to say that I heard a rumor that this book had like rules for the biggest spaceships we've ever seen, but you kind of just confirmed that. So
yep.
Biggest spaceships we've ever seen, question mark.
Yeah, no, Ultronauts are an entire size category larger than the biggest things in the core rulebook. They are things that fall in the fleet carrier, by which I mean the ship that carries a whole fleet of other ships, or the mobile city. If you want to, I don't know how many people remember Alternity or the Star Drive setting, but it had a really wonderful thing called the Lighthouse, which was a mobile space station that would teleport through hyperspace from system to system. If you want to do that, or, you know, the Galactica or any of the other you can be here for your entire life size things, that's what Ultronauts are designed to do.
What if I want to build the Death Star? Will this let me make a Death Star?
No.
Oh.
No, because we don't, if a GM wants a Death Star, then what he wants is a plot device. That's like saying, can I build a deity, right? We can tell you what stats you need for that, but that is a place where a GM says, as a result of the plot, probably the thing that is driving the plot, there is this thing, whatever this thing is. And it's not something that you should otherwise ever need to know. Oh, my Ultronaut can only have 2 spinal mount main weapons coming out the front. I wanted 4 for it. No, it's, you know, that's there's this stuff, which is reasonable and on some sort of scale, although in this case that scale is like the, it's like saying we've got ancient red dragons, right? It's designed for upper end play, but there's that versus things like the Death Star, which are and the One Ring and artifacts. That's all stuff that we don't really need to tell you how to make. That whatever you need that to do is what it does.
So this is that big ship that flies in episode 4 after like the scrolly yellow text, the bum. Yes. Bum. Okay. All right. So it's not the Death Star. It's Vader's ship.
It's a Star Destroyer.
There you go. I'm glad you're way better at Star Wars than me, Mister. I wrote the Star Wars RPG that everybody remembers and loves.
It is specifically the Star Destroyer Avenger, which Darth Vader hung out on until he moved to the Executor, the Super Star Destroyer.
Of course he did. You out-nerded me. It's not very difficult to do, but I just want to make sure that you... It is on public record that I was out-nerded.
I'm the guest, and you're being very kind. If you wanted to move to, like, Steven Universe references, you would then be able to out-nerd me.
That's fair. But no, I can't, because all the new episodes are spoilers, so I can't say anything. It's not cool.
Yeah, well, you knew that, so that itself, you've out-nerded me just by saying why you can't out-nerd me.
Oh, whoops.
So, Empire Bones. I am delighted by how that thing came out. I'll be honest, my wife helped me with the maps because my ability to detect a good map is superior to my ability to create a good map. Jason Keeley was the developer on that. He did a lovely job. Liz Liddell was at least one of the editors, and she made some suggestions that made it even better than it was when I conceived it. I've gotten some positive feedback on it already, but it's also just – it's something off my bucket list that I've been wanting to do since Second Darkness. So I'm delighted to finally have a Paizo AP under my belt, and now I'm never writing an adventure again as long as I live.
Really? Was that rough of an experience?
So adventures are a very different kind of writing than the vast majority of what I do. And I've written some. I've written some that have been very well regarded. The any award-winning set of adventures for Razor Coast, I wrote one of. I did the adventure that was the Star Wars Fast Play adventure, for example. That was 17 years ago. So I've done it, and I can produce adventures that people seem to enjoy. But as a GM, it is very exciting for me to write an adventure up to the point where I have all the necessary notes that I can run it. The gap between everything I need to know to run an adventure and everything someone that just buys a book needs to know to run an adventure is a huge gap of, for me, much harder writing than most of what I do. And some of that is experience. But some of it is just that it's you got to balance a lot of concerns, right? You're looking at how much loot have I passed out? How much of that is stuff that is going to be useless to the players and I can't charge full value for that? What are they likely to miss? What are the what happens if I have a room and they die and they don't get through it? Is there some other way around? And, you know, Rob McCreary, who's very experienced with adventures, worked with me on the outline. And so I had a great deal of confidence in it going into it. But the cognitive load is just different on me. And I currently, that was one straw too many for the number of dozens of things I was doing all at once. And I kind of burned out after I wrote that adventure and luckily had a long holiday break. But right now my feeling is that one adventure every 5 or 6 years rate I have been producing them is probably fine.
This reminds me of an Owenism that Owen told me about camels and straw breakings.
Well, what is it?
Yeah. The camel can't blame which straw breaks his back. Something like that.
Does that sound right? Camel can't complain about any one straw, even if it's the one that broke its back.
That's it. Yeah. There you go.
No, hold on. Owenisms?
Oh, Owen has tons of them. It's great.
Okay.
When people ask me questions or want advice or are business partners or are people I frequently turn to with offers of freelance work or are all of those things, sometimes those lessons come in the form of idioms or sayings or the dreaded words, let me tell you a story, which Agunis has decided to call Owenisms. That's Owenisms. Not my term.
Yep. It's a great term. Yeah. Anyone from the Starfinder team who wants to steal that for work, please spread the love.
All right.
Thanks, Alex.
The other book that's kind of far in the future, you'll probably have even less to talk about, but that you all did tease a lot of during the PazoCon panels, is Alien Archive 2. Anything you can say on that to get people excited?
Alien Archive 2 is sort of got filled out the same way Armory did, in that we looked at what are things we're missing that seem to be popular that people would like to see. And I don't want to jump the shark. I don't want to jump the gun. It's a different thing to jump. Mm-hmm. I don't want to jump the shark with a laser gun on its head, because there will be preview blogs and I'm sure there's a specific plan for it. But it follows the same basic format. We have a ton of new aliens and some new playable races. Where it is appropriate, we have added material that is sort of player-facing related to each of these things, which helps a GM develop treasure that's appropriate, or if you want to play one of the player races, gives you some unique cultural element that you can draw on. We have a set of universal creature rules, all the necessary appendices. I think we've got a little more indexing in this one than we did in the first one, because we didn't have to include the character, the monster creation rules, so that gave us a little more room to play with. And like the summoning spells in the first one, we have a similar set of spells, which I am literally going to the internet to see if we've said what they are. But there's an additional set of material with that as well. And I mean, obviously, I always hope it'll be well received. Mm-hmm. Bestiaries are popular, so it is my hope that this will be well received and help people tell the kind of adventures that they want to tell.
You said something interesting there, that you weren't going to need to have the alien creation rules in Alien Archive 2, whereas the Pathfinder bestiaries seem to reprint almost all of the basic rules so that they're almost independent. So does the Alien Archive 2 assume ownership of Alien Archive 1?
So you can use just Alien Archive 2 in that, for example, if we refer to a universal creature rule, we made sure to include that in the appendix. So if you're pulling monsters out of Alien Archive 2, you don't need Alien Archive 1 to use it. But we did not feel we needed to repeat, here's how to make a monster from scratch. That is an appendix that we put in Alien Archive 1, which is the most core of them. So if you want to be able to do that thing, to make new creatures and NPCs, you need Alien Archive 1 to do that. But you can use Alien Archive 2 without any of the material from 1. Mm-hmm. And I just found our preview for Alien Archive 2 or a description of it, which specifically says that it includes complete magical polymorphing rules. So we did mention, and I can say that, like, there's summoning rules in the first one, there's polymorphing rules in the second one.
Man, polymorphing gets exciting when you start thinking of some of the critters that can be in all of space.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why it's not in the core rulebook, right? Is that we knew that we were going to have some pretty wild and crazy things, and that the original polymorph rules from Pathfinder might not accommodate that well. And certainly we did not want to have, right, we didn't want to have Form of the Undead and Form of the Hyperintelligent Shade of Blue and Form of the Skittermander and Form of the, right, we're going to have a lot of different kinds of things, and they aren't all necessarily going to be equally weighted. So we wanted to handle that differently. But like some of the stuff in Armory, where we had to see how the core rulebook was received before we could build on it, we wanted to see how our entire alien building set and what aliens we'd already included were received by the community and how they worked and where there might be issues with them before we wrote up a set of polymorph rules. Polymorphing is just always going to be somewhat more complicated than some other forms of magic, too. And that's another thing. If you are buying Alien Archive 2, you are probably not feeling that you are a beginner to this game. So the cognitive load we can ask you to take on for fun is somewhat greater. They are still entirely optional, right? You can play a, you can buy Alien Archive 2 and say, nope, I don't want to deal with polymorphing. It's out. We're not doing it. And that's fine. But there are people that are excited about that kind of concept, and we want to support them if we can.
Mm-hmm. I am excited about that kind of concept.
Fingers crossed, Ezelguns. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
We will see. Well, you'll see. I know already.
Obviously. Yeah, you know. You were just bogarting all the information. But that, I can wait. I can be patient.
Mm-hmm. Can you, though? Ken, you're actually way more patient than I am. I shouldn't make that joke.
Now, Starfinder is going to have a presence at Gen Con this year. What should people, what can people be excited about what the Starfinder is going to be doing at the biggest gaming convention?
Well, we've got some seminars and panels that we're doing, things like Secrets of the Pack Worlds. I'm on some of those. So is everyone on the Starfinder team, I believe. So that's an opportunity to come talk to us, ask questions if there are specific things that you're just dying to know what a Temple of Serenrae would look like on EX, for example. Then you can come and ask us those burning questions, and we'll hem and we'll haw and we'll try to answer them.
I didn't know I wanted that answer as bad as I do now.
Yeah, well, there you go. Come to Gen Con. Obviously, Armory is coming out. I think we'll certainly have Empire Bones there, but some people already have it. We'll be coming out. And then there's a lot of organized play stuff that is happening that I recommend people go to the organized play forums on Paizo.com and look them up. A lot of those will already be signed up for, but they're for some games, there's almost always tables. And if you haven't ever been up to the Sagamore Ballroom, which is where Paizo does its organized play, but it used to be part of Sagamore Ballroom, and then it was half of Sagamore Ballroom, and then it was most of Sagamore Ballroom, and then a couple of years ago it became all of the Sagamore Ballroom, which is an enormous space, right? It's larger than some people's hometowns. Mm-hmm. Going in there and seeing 1,000 people playing on hundreds of tables, all doing the same geek thing we do, can be a lot of fun. And there are some great volunteers that we appreciate greatly. And there's a foundation that runs the organized play stuff for us. So we appreciate all of that very, very much. So I think looking into what games are being run through organized play is a big part of what you should be doing about Starfinder at Gen Con.
Sweet. Now you're going
I'm excited. I get to run a lot of Starfinder.
Mm-hmm. Are you running a lot of Starfinder organized play? Do you know what you're running yet?
Duskmire Accord, and also the special.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if anyone can get into the special at this point, but if you can, the specials are special. It's mm-hmm. it's a different gaming experience. It's very much worth
it. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
It's like that orc concept of groupthink, except you're all playing a game instead of trying to make something go to space, but it has that same type of energy.
That's
although fun. In this case, you may also be trying to make something go to space.
Yeah, actually probably because of the game.
And it's going to be great. It's the Scoured Stars invasion. It's mm-hmm. going to be awesome. I'm so excited.
Yeah, and they're full production affairs. You guys usually have like sound effects and like projectors with game aids posted up on the walls, and sometimes some of your crew even come in costume. I don't know if that's the plan this year or what that's going to be, but we have seen that happen many a times.
Yes, it's, I would I would never reveal what's going to happen in this specific year, but yeah, that's all stuff that's happened in past years, and we are aware of how popular those elements are. And again, that's the organized play team that really going way beyond any reasonable call to make sure that their jobs are more difficult than they have to be in order to make a great experience for people. So I am in awe of everyone on that team.
And it's something you just can't experience just about anywhere else. The amount of energy, the amount of players there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about how you feel, James, but like even when we play the specials at home compared to Gen Con, it's not the same.
No. The more people you do, the better. So there was one special, Solstice Scar, which is made for smaller tables, which I think feels pretty similar depending on where you're at. But other specials, definitely. The more size, the more epic it gets.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you're going to be there if you're presenting at panels. So you're going to be at Gen Con?
Yes, I will be at Gen Con. I will not necessarily be at the Paizo booth all that often because I am going as part of a vacation rather than as part of my work for Paizo. But I'm still doing a lot of Paizo panels. I expect to be at the Ennies, for example, in case we win, because I have worked on projects that won Ennies, and I've been to the Ennies, but never both of those at the same time. I'll be around. You can follow me on my social media to figure out where I'm going to be at any given moment to hunt me down. And if you're someone in the industry or who wants to be in the industry who's looking for an opportunity to talk to me and you don't get out to the West Coast all that often and you're going to Gen Con, this is a good time to try and track me down. I'm not saying that buying me lunch will end up meaning that you'll win RPG Superstar or start your own gaming company, but both those things have happened.
They have.
Yeah, I heard Alex buys a lot of lunches for Owen.
No, actually, every time we try, it doesn't end up happening.
Aww.
Do you remember at PaizoCon, I tried tracking you down for drinks like 3 times, and it wasn't until like day 3 that I got you?
Yes, and by then someone else was already buying me drinks.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. So but, I just
see, Alex is supposed to have a list of questions to ask me when he gets around to buying me drinks.
I'm supposed to, but then like, I never remember them, so
that's
like,
why you write them down and make a list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the way I see it is that if I forget them, they probably weren't that important, and anything that I actually do think to say to you in the moment probably is more important than them.
That's fair.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious. You said you were going there as part of the vacation. So, what is just nerdy fan Owen looking forward to doing at Gen Con? That, like, let's just scrap Starfinder related stuff. Like, what is the fan in you going to be doing at a convention that big?
I'm going to spend as much time as it takes to walk the dealer's hall, which again is a ridiculously large room. And I do that a little faster than I used to, because it used to be that is how I found out what companies were doing, was seeing what they've got new at Gen Con. The internet has made that much less of an issue than it was, say, in the late 90s. So for a lot of companies, I already know what they're doing, but it's also a great time to see things like, here are the first print run of miniatures or models or terrain that isn't actually out yet. There are also a lot of artists there in the artist alley and small novelists. There's an entrepreneur zone, and I heartily recommend everyone take the time to go to the small shops in the entrepreneur zone, go through the artist alley. But there's also sort of away from the entrances in the larger numbers in the, you know, aisles 2100, 2200, 2400, 2700 maybe. There are smaller companies, and some of them, they have saved their money and made their big push for this, and therefore you've never seen them or heard from them before. And some of them have really cool stuff. Mm-hmm. So I always think it's worth it to go. Sometimes it's even not as well lit back there, but to sort of the dark hinterlands of the dealer's room and walk up and down the aisles and talk to people, see what they're excited about. I mean, some of them have, you know, here's E&E, which is absolutely not just my version of D&D, but with a chart for the different weapons and how they react to dragon scales, right? Okay, that product is probably there, but there's also a lot of really neat, innovative stuff. Not all of which is just a role-playing game, right? There are people that do terrain. There are people that have computer programs, art, social media. There's a lot of stuff. And the thing I've never heard of or that I hadn't even thought of is always what I am most excited by to see back there.
Back there is where I first met Arknight Games with their really cool little the templates. It's the first place I ever saw Hexographer, and that's an amazing piece of software, and they also have a space version that's fantastic for Starfinder. There's all kinds of really cool stuff.
Yeah, those are great examples. It's also a place where you can meet Zombie Orpheus, the people that do the Gamers series, are going to be there. And so you can meet some of the people that have been responsible for some of the media that you enjoy. And that can be fun. But try not to clog their sales point or eat up too much of their time. But and then the other thing I'm going to be doing once I'm pry myself loose from the dealer's hall, I've got a lot of friends in the industry who don't happen to live in Seattle. So this is an opportunity for me to hang out with and spend time with and talk to and sometimes make deals with people that I don't get to see any other time. And so that's really, really nice. I always like to hit Scotty's Brewhouse, which has game-related themed menus. And it's not that the food tastes better because they're alchemical pickles, although the goblin pickles did taste better because they were goblin pickles, I'm telling you. But there's this opportunity. Scotty's is obviously piezo-themed, but there's a similar opportunity at the Ram most years to sit in a professional venue where they have embraced us geeks and our gaming culture. And there are posters on the wall, and at the Ram they frequently have, like, you know, the Dolph Lundgren He-Man movie on, or Star Wars or whatever, instead of sports. And it's just a very different environment, and it's not something I get most of the time. I do actually now have the AFK in driving distance, so I get it more than most people. But it's still fun to do it with that press of hundreds of other people like me. There's usually a board game library. I heartily recommend that because you can go and pick up a game you've never, ever heard of and give it a try. And I've certainly bought games after playing them there. There are also frequently demos, demo spaces in the dealer's room, and I recommend that as well. My first exposure to Apples was someone who was just demoing it in the dealer's room, and my wife and I tried it with four or five other people, and we're like, well, this is the most awesome game ever, and so we bought a copy and have several expansions for that matter. So sometimes there's geek media, like premieres of fan films and such. I haven't looked into that yet this year because I suspect I'm going to be sleeping in late and going to bed early, which often means I'm going to be cutting off the ends where those things would happen. But if that sort of thing appeals to you, I recommend going to the GenCon.com page and looking at all the events which they already have listed. And then there are seminars. There are tons of seminars that I think are very, very important. This is frequently one of the few places where people who are otherwise marginalized or don't have their voice broadcast or heard well frequently get to speak here. And I have learned a lot, and I've met some great people and even made some friends going to seminars just that struck me as interesting or sometimes important. It can also be a great place to make contacts sometimes. A lot of seminar people will say, hey, I've got business cards up here, so if you want one, come and grab it. And if you do that, you can then, you know, email them a few days later if you actually want to contact. You say, oh, I was at your seminar at Gen Con on this subject. That was great. And it led me to this question. Do you mind if I ask you this by email? And that makes that connection, which is different from looking up my email on paizo.com and saying, you've never heard of me, bud. And people do that, and that's fine for me, but I think a lot of people want to have that connections before they try to talk to people. Mm-hmm. So those are all important to me, Gen Con events.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned on your social that there's another con you're going to be attending after Gen Con.
Yes. In September, I will be at Grand Con, Grand Rapids, Michigan. I can't tell you as much about what to do at that con because this is the first year I will be going, but I will be a guest there. And I know I'm running a couple of charity games. And I don't know if that's up on the schedule yet or not. It might be. But if so, certainly those would be an opportunity to game with me in case that is something that interests you. No one on this podcast has ever gamed with me, I don't think. So they
nope,
can't say
I have once. It. Once.
You have?
Remember? Oh, so I ran part one of Thornkeep.
So you and, yep. And you played with us for a bit. Okay, so Alex can tell you whether it is worthwhile to game with me or not. He has actual firsthand experience.
Owen's mastery of the rules combined with a delightful penchant for making memorable characters makes him someone that you should game with if you can.
Okay, so there you go. So that would be something that could happen at Grand Con. There's a lot of other great guests and stuff going. And again, Grand Con has a website that you can go and look at all the stuff they're doing.
Excellent. Okay, we're almost out of time, so is there anything else you want to shout out to before we call it?
I mentioned the great forums, the Starfinder forums at paizo.com. If you are just getting into the game, if you've got questions, if you want If you're running the APs, for example, there are people that put together whole threads of useful GM resources for people that are running those games. So I heartily recommend those. And if you find that you want more content than Paizo is creating, obviously there are a lot of third-party publishers, and most of them sell on the Open Game Store or on Paizo.com, which has its own store, which is great, or on DriveThruRPG.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Also, where can people get in touch with you or follow your work that sort of stuff, your socials and the hashtags? And
yes. So I've got a website, which is owenkcstevens.com. Mm-hmm. I am found on Facebook at facebook.com/owenkcstevens. And I ought to have had this up, but I am also on Twitter, and I think it's, it's @Owen_Stevens on Twitter. And those are all places where you can talk to me, follow me, see what I'm doing, see what I think is important, see the cat pictures I think are worth posting.
Well, thank you, Owen, for joining us this week. And also...
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
Awesome. Also...
So we need to have you on 6 more times so that you can catch up to Keely, right?
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Okay.
Keely!
We also want to thank our Patreon supporters, because it's only through your support that shows like this are possible. We appreciate every little bit that helps, and we thank you.
Deeply.
Mm-hmm. A lot.
You can find more No Direction work at NoDirectionPodcast.com. You can also find us at Facebook.com/NoDirection or watch us live on Twitch.tv/NoDirection. We also have the Patreon and Twitter and our YouTube page, all linked on NoDirectionPodcast.com, where you'll find this show and other amazing shows just like it, including our No Direction Prime, that is our Pathfinder show, and No Direction Adventurous, which is our actual play show where we're running through War for the Crown with Crystal Frazier as our GM, and it is amazingly fun stuff.
And I have played with Crystal Frazier, and I can tell you that's worth watching. If you have an opportunity to do it in person, do that too. But it is just worth watching to see her run a game.
I cannot understand how she does so many unique characters at once. She did a ballroom scene, and it was insane.
Crystal is amongst the most talented people in gaming. I mean, she can pretty much do everything I can do, and cartography, and art, and layout, and voices. And I think she could arm wrestle me. So she's just phenomenal.
I've heard that she's prone to glitter bombs too.
I wouldn't say prone.
Right. Oh, but you forgot one of our social media outlets, Param.
Which one?
James has politely reminded you on the Twitch stream. Yes,
indeed.
You know, the really important one.
Indeed, it might be our favorite. If you want to hang out amongst a super chill and toxic-free community about the fandom for Starfinder and Pathfinder and other great nerdity, or any of our shows or content, or just talking nerd stuff with us here at No Direction,
Gundams.
You can... Oh, yeah, and lots of Gundams. Giant robots are amazing, and you should always enjoy giant robots. You can do so at our Discord server, and you can find the link to that on NoDirectionPodcast.com over on the right with the rest of their social media. It's also the easiest way to get in touch with us and ask us random questions. All right, until next time, go beyond.